we need to talk a little bit about James Gunn. So
are we recording?
Yeah, we're recording.
Okay. So
I went to Jamestown over the holidays with my family, checking out the monuments and historical things, and I was struck by this rather nice museum about the history of Jamestown, way outside of Williamsburg, or like kind of outside of Williamsburg. And my immediate
thought, is like a nowhere place to begin with.
Right. It's woods and water and like a couple of ancient structures that are not that ancient. And then this massive, very nice museum. And my immediate thought as a former congressional staffer and congressional scholar is this an earmark?
maybe who's earmark?
Pretty good.
I mean, I know Virginia loves its history, but even in that context, it seemed a little out of place.
Virginia's infatuated with its own history. I mean, this is like a multi-part. I did not know this because I did not grow up in Virginia, but I have kids in Virginia schools, and we dedicate a block of their early education to, like, here's all the stuff that happened in Virginia. Yeah. It's like, as we know it, which means starting in, like, you know, around 1600 or so. But,
oh, God.
And being a native Marylander, the whole time I kept thinking, I was like, oh, this looks like exactly like St. Mary's City. It's just the Virginia version.
It's very interesting. Well, we've got J.D. Racky here on the podcast.
Yeah, warm welcome to J.D.
Matt, myself, and Laura as well. And we're going to talk to J.D. because J.D. just put out a report. We're talking about congressional primaries, right?
Yeah.
First, let's just do a little bit of an introduction. I was delighted
for people who don't know you, J.D.
I guess. I'm Matt Glassman. I'm your fellow here.
Nobody cares.
But JD's at the Bipartisan Policy Center right now, and he worked for a long time on the Modernization Committee as an APSA fellow.
Modernization Committee was a select committee in the House to improve congressional operations or chamber operations.
Speaker ever fire the chair of the Modernization Committee? That ever happened?
No.
We'll get to that later.
A lot of signposting here on the show.
Yes.
Anyway, we're delighted to have him as another happy, good government person on the show. But we also wanted to talk a little bit about his report that he did on primary elections impact behavior in the U.S. House of Representatives with Michael Thorning, another fan of the podcast, especially since we might have a whole bunch of primary threats of folks. Take it away, J.D.
Yeah. So first, thanks for having me. Long-time listener, first-time follower.
Yes! What we like to hear.
Yes. Michael and I did this report kind of out of the... coming from the narrative that primary threats kind of might cause members to behave in ways that kind of increase dysfunction and extreme policy making, decline in partisan lawmaking, out of the kind of factual information that primary electorates are not representative of the general electorate or even the pool of eligible voters. And so we interviewed a bunch of members of Congress, former members, senior congressional staff, to figure out, kind of unpack the ways that in which primary election threats influence member behavior. Short version is primaries do matter a lot. they weigh heavily on members' mentality. The more nuanced version is it's irregardless of whether a member actually faces a primary challenge. It's just always that fear that's lurking behind them. And this is confirming previous research by Lane K. Mark and James Wallner, who kind of conclude the same thing. Kind of under the surface, we kind of look at legislative impacts.
Well, before we get there, I want to talk a little more about this, because this is one of those things that flies under the radar in some respects. It's hard to quantify the effect of primaries because we don't see primaries challengers successful very often. They're just not very successful, right? You can count on three hands, like, the number of people who have lost in a congressional primary, number of incumbents who have lost in a congressional primary in the last 10 years, right? It's not just not many in the overall scheme of things. And yet, it seems like an almost ubiquitous concern among lawmakers, right? Okay. So it's not something you could tease out with data, but it's something you talk to somebody, and they're like, yes, this is something I'm thinking about. Like, it's 15% of people who are going to show up in, like, a random August or June or July or whenever it is that that particular primary is.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point by Josh. Not it only is it not a whole, not very observable because there are so few successful primary challenges, but it also, you know, what you're hearing from practitioners is goes in the face of what you see in a lot of the political science research, which tends to have the point of view that primaries don't matter that much, or gerrymandering only accounts for so much polarization, relatively low levels, far lower than, like, the emotional feelings that you get from members of Congress or their staff. And, you know, something that you see with so many things in life, but also politics, but, like, their feelings matter. Like, they have feelings about primaries because they have a lived experience. And it may not be showing up in a data set, like Josh suggests, but, you know, they are changing their behaviors because they're anticipating things.
Right.
Yeah, it also has that feel of just another thing in politics where the members are behaving some way because they're worried about outcome X, and because they do what they need to do, outcome X never comes to the fore.
Right.
And, you know, the classic one of this that I think people forget is we always say members are unbeatable in the general, they're in a safe seat. It's not really true. They're only in a safe seat as long as they continue to behave the way they're behaving. Right? They will be beaten if they flip their votes on every roll call.
Yeah.
And so when you take that to the primaries, so, well, there's no primary challengers. It's because the members are doing what they need to do to avoid them. And that has that's a huge difference in behavior than, say, we instantly adopted the British system and there were no primaries.
Right. It's also a function of, to Josh's point, like, while there's not many successful primaries, the ones that are successful hold a lot of weight in member mindset and the popular narrative about the threat of primaries. So when Eric Cantor beat or Dave Bratt beat Eric Cantor, and when Elliot Engel lost, and all these kind of big national narrative primary losses, I think kind of sticks in members' minds in a way that, you know, quantitative research about this phenomenon doesn't really bear out.
Right. Yeah, so tell us what it was like to do these interviews. I mean,
We interviewed a range of people from floor staff to kind of members from safe seats, members from swing seats, members who had been there a long time, members who had only been there a few cycles. We gave them all anonymity so that they would be more open with us, and they had a lot of feelings about primaries.
Of course they did.
To your point, Laura, that you know, kind of they, I don't know, they very hostile to the idea of primaries. By and large,
you mean like the general, the idea of a primary? There will be an election election?
No, the idea of that they would be challenged.
Oh, okay.
For the nomination.
I kind of liked it when they were hostile to the whole system. like a more cantankerous.
They were starting to get some
These are ridiculous. Like, oh, I want to talk to that guy.
No, more like incumbents have the view that, like, you know, I'm the incumbent, I've been working my tail off for my district and doing all these things, how dare this upstart who may or may not be from the district, who may or may not have support of the community, kind of come in and try to take me out for perceived or real lack of doing the job. But, you know, generally the interviews were cool. As a political scientist, this was the reason I wanted to be a political scientist, was kind of the qualitative Fenno and Mayhew soaking and poking. Yeah. I mean, this is the first project that I've been able to do that on, so it was pretty cool.
That's very fun.
Did you get a sense of member, like, not just like anger about it, but frustration? Because it feels to me that even if you have sort of pure motives and you just want to represent your district, having to shift over to this smaller coalition and cater to them would just be very frustrating from a representative point of view.
I think there was frustration to that. The most frustration we heard was about the lack of national, state, and local party apparatuses in helping kind of fend off these primary threats and wanting to be protected from kind of these what one member described as ghoulish people trying to run.
I almost feel like it's the opposite now, that when the parties weren't so nationalized and it was very decentralized, you're less likely. I don't know if the data supports that, but I feel like the word primary is a verb, is a very modern word that goes with nationalization. And the president, I mean, I think the received wisdom of the 20th century was that Roosevelt's attempt to purge the Southerners in 38 was a complete disaster.
Yes.
And then the National Party never again tried to primary people, unless it was like some outrageous person who was embarrassing the party in some way. But no one ever tried to just move policy to the left or right by primarying people from the 30s right through sort of the 21st century, when it came into vogue all of a sudden, either from activists or from the party. And now you got, you know, the president-elect very openly talking about primarying people, and putting this thought into members' heads.
Yeah, well, I mean, you have the advent of successful ideological primaries in 2009 and 2010, right? So this is Robert Boatwright's work, our listening nerds know. But, you know, previously you don't have successful ideological primaries. So it's not just a question of tactics, but it's also seems like a question of party strength. And it sounds like, you know, from what you're saying, that they're not finding strong enough state and local policies for protection.
Well, one of the things, I'm going to shoehorn a story in here because I have to. It's just too good of a primary story.
Is there an accent involved?
What's that? There's no accent involved. But in FDR's purge in 38, one of the guys he targeted was the Rules Committee chairman, John O'Connor from New York. And he successfully purged O'Connor. O'Connor lost his primary and then ran as the Republican for his old against the challenger Democrat.
Sucker.
And then he lost the general. And so he lost twice. He lost a seat twice in a single election. And that was one of the very few that FDR was able to put up. But to the point, one of the reasons that FDR had such limited success was the fact that state and local parties were so strong. Like, they were able to kind of control the candidates that were put up there. And nationally, this has been really interesting, and I'd like to get your perspective on this. It seems like nationally, the primaries that parties focus on, they typically do pretty well. Like, when they're coordinated and kind of all aligned in terms of like the network or whatever kind of like blob party is out there. Whenever they're aligned, they seem to win. It's the problem that like they just are not really paying attention to a lot of these lower level or safe seat primaries, where they're the donors, the network, the whole party apparatus is not kind of in alignment.
Deep breath.
And yes, and they sort of like, this is a red seat or this is a blue seat, we won't pay attention to it because it's going to be red or blue regardless. And that's where we start to see a little bit more success among challengers.
Yeah, I think that plays into exactly what I was going to say, is it's kind of disparate impacts of party strength. So one thing that our respondents told us was, in Congress, the party is pretty good about the negative agenda control and keeping things off the floor that would put members in a tough primary position. But at the same time, and so that kind of leads to like a more coordinated, stronger national party, or where they're paying attention, they're succeeding. But on the other hand,
tip to Hans Hassel, by the way, he's got excellent research on this. I want to mention.
Yes,
I'm like over here. I'm like parroting his research. Yeah. I like say his name. Might as well.
But where they're not paying attention, and where the parties tend to be weaker, particularly state and local parties, is where members identified like the challenges are coming from. We had one quote in the report that said like, we try to make sure we have a consistent presence in the county party meetings, because if we're not, then that's usually where the tension bubbles up.
we've got some problem spots. That's really interesting. So were you able to, did you gauge like from members where you had kind of stronger state party apparatuses versus weaker state party apparatuses? Could you sense from them? There was like, for example, is a place like Nevada, which has got a kind of a stronger state party, did you hear less about these concerns than a place that, say, I don't know, Florida on the Democratic side?
Yeah. Our N was kind of small.
Yeah, I guess. So and not only that, you can't not reveal yourself. Yeah,
we only interviewed 14 people, so I don't know if we have enough to speak to that.
Interesting.
Okay. But moving on to kind of impacts about it, we kind of, the two biggest areas we paid attention to, one we specifically asked questions about, was how does this impact your legislative agenda?
Yeah.
And what was interesting to me, probably not revolutionary for political scientists, but it did, a lot of our respondents said it has almost no impact on what they choose to sponsor or co-sponsor. that a lot of those decisions were still being made based on what's relevant to their district,
but
that it weighs heavily on their vote choice.
Absolutely. That's really interesting.
Which we know. And then the other piece that kind of emerged naturally, like we didn't even initially start asking questions about it, but members brought it up, was how much it influences their communication style. And, you know, we have some quotes in the piece where, like, a lot of the members said, you know, I normally try to, like, build consensus and respect amongst my colleagues and be kind of, you know, not bombastic. But then I get a primary challenge saying that, who doesn't disagree with me at all on policy, just that I'm not using the bully pulpit enough. And I think that is contributing to a lot of this narrative about, like, primaries polarizing us and things like, I don't know if it always is polarizing us. It's just
from a policy perspective.
It's just changing the culture around Congress.
Sure, and the rhetoric.
I mean, and you can, that feels intuitively correct too, if you just look at the Hill, like, and sort of the behavior of members, where, like, they don't want to be photographed with members of the other party. They don't want to be seen sort of agreeing with them in committees, right? They don't want to be seen as sort of just, like, pleasantly disagreeing with people sometimes, right? That's disconcerting.
I mean,
there's
a reason the Modernization Committee made a recommendation to build bipartisan member spaces that are out of view of the press and the public.
We've talked about Kilmer and his management perspective, but just, you know, having them all sit around a table, like, next to somebody of a different party. So, like, the incentive isn't to be like, ooh, like, this side of the room wants to, you know, body slam that side of the room. Sorry, that's more Senate, right? That's a Mark Wayne Mullen
type
comment.
But that's sort of the reality of it. Sometimes you see on the Hill, as soon as you are in a non-public space with the members, for a tremendous proportion of the members, the animosity just sort of falls away. It's gone. The one that always strikes out to me, you know, in my mind, is I was at an event at the library, some speaker series they were doing on Monday nights back in the day. It was sort of to encourage sort of members to come in to town on Mondays and do sort of a bipartisan thing. And it was some historian talking about Irish immigrants to the U.S. or
Gordon
something like
Wood.
That. What?
Gordon
Was it Gordon Wood? Were
Gordon
you there?
Wood.
I was there. And Meadows and Connolly were there sitting together, yucking it up, having the greatest time, asking Gordon Wood questions. And it's like Meadows and Connolly. And it's like, I mean, these guys don't agree on policy. And if you see them in any sort of public capacity, they're at each other's throats about this, that, whatever. And they're just talking about Irish immigration and just yucking it up with each other. And, like, that is, you know, I mean, in one sense, it's like, well, you have to have sort of a, you know, private preferences and public sort of voting records and things like that. But to the degree that sort of the primaries are creating that atmosphere is not great, especially because I think there's plenty of copycat younger members who just decide that that's the attitude.
Well, that's really it.
That's the beginning and the end.
And I mean, you have, like, kind of these old classic stories that sound like that, right? Like Teddy Kennedy being like, oh, you know, like, I'll co-sponsor Republicans all day long, and if they need to say mean things about them about me during their campaigns, like, that's totally cool. You know, it's Reagan and Tip O'Neill, like, having a drink after 6 p.m. But I feel like there is something kind of above and beyond with the environment that we've been in for the past 10-15 years.
I do think it's hard to get back to the other environment, though, because for most members of Congress these days, they hear the Tip O'Neill, Reagan stories as history.
Right.
Very few. There's only like a third of members, current members, were even in Congress prior to, like, the Obama administration. And so there's the number of people on the Hill who remember a different way of politicking and a different way of legislating
That's one of my favorite stats. Just like how many people even remember. Like appropriations, you know, the older regimes.
We still hear stories about this, though. I mean, there was a great one, was it today or yesterday? Tammy Duckworth was up in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. They were, Marco Rubio was the Secretary of State nominee. He was up in front of the hearing, and the first thing Tammy Duckworth says, like, when I got to the Senate, I was fighting for childcare privileges because I had a brand new baby. I couldn't bring it on the floor. Like, I'm a new mother. and you came running up behind me and said, I'm with you, I support you, or whatever. And that's like, that's one of those things where you start to see, like, the cameras are gone, and it's just a very simple thing, a simple gesture of humanity, right? But I do wonder, like, even creating bipartisan spaces away from cameras, are we ever going to get to a point where the incentive to, when you are in front of a camera, is just to hammer the other side? Like, even if we create these kind of, like, what unquote, literally, quote-unquote, safe spaces, right? Is it going to get rid of that incentive?
Yeah, I don't think so. And, I mean, we conclude in the report that, you know, these efforts at primary reform, while our other research lane from previous BPC research shows that it does increase turnout and make more representative electorates, we kind of conclude at the end, like, we don't think primary reform on its own is really going to change the incentive structure of Congress to, because all of the fundraising that happens from this, the televised brawl, all of the kind of larger party incentives just are still there. And so I don't know if we can reform just that side of things.
Right.
One
of
the things
that really, like, resonated with me, I mean, I feel like you hear a lot about ranked choice voting, and this is kind of like the new thing where people see the shiny thing.
It was the new thing. Now it's the dying thing.
And it's like, like, there's a larger system. I think you know, your report was well taken in that. You know, there are other contexts at play here.
I do think it's sort of almost strange to think about members of the House being cajoled by primary challengers or the voters responding to primary challengers to be more sort of like publicly angry, as if like 35 years ago you had any sense of what your member of Congress was saying in public at any time, right? Or the style they were doing it as a voter, right?
Yeah.
And that is sort of, I've been thinking a lot lately about sort of the increased amount of congressional politics which takes place in the public sphere just in general.
Mm-hmm.
And this is certainly a part of it. But it fits in as sort of, in my mind, a little bit lamentable about, on a transparency dimension, is that it's not necessarily the optimal place where you want the random member of Congress to think that that's where politics happens. And if you have a primary system that incentivizes it to happen there, it's going to happen there. I don't think it's surprising that Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz and Lauren Boebert and AOC eat up a lot of the oxygen in public, but they are younger members who have a very public strategy, and they're also members who are responding to sort of modern incentives. So I don't think the trajectory is heading away from that.
No, and you also see that with staffing trends, right? There's been an increase over time in the number of communication staff being hired and less policy staff being hired. And that's kind of a cyclical pattern. Like, members want more comms, so they hire more comms. But then you get more comms out of it on the back end too, right?
Including on committee staff, where you're like, Muffin, you don't have any constituents.
Who's the one termer from North Carolina who claimed he only did comms staff?
What's his face?
Madison
Cawthorn.
He didn't hire any.
He's going to be a commercial footnote, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No policy staff.
He's a bar trivia question.
It is remarkable.
Your bar trivia question, my footnote.
It is remarkable, though. I mean, like, today, hearing about a congressional office without a press secretary of some shape or another is unheard of. That's just not a thing that happens anymore. Whereas, like, in previous decades, that happened. Like, you just had policy staff in D.C., right? It wasn't, and somebody, like, had press as, like, a side thing or possibly. But today, it's like, there's no way there's a staff without a press staff.
Yeah. And it's interesting to me, because then you also have studies, like, from Francis Lee and Cyril Gaynor that look at the role of party contributing more to the comms apparatuses and building the party brand. And so leadership staff and committee staff will put together packets of tweets and press releases and things and send them out to the members' offices. And if all of that's happening from the member from the leadership level, why do member offices need all these comms stuff?
This is one of those things where I like to think of it as just sort of like the informal, like, you know, what's the right word for it? It's kind of like the touchy-feely, like, team group, like, leadership-driven, like, we're a team, guys. You know, like, it's like we're all together. It's like the annoying boss that nobody really wants to listen to and, like, giving you, like, a pep talk. That's what leaders... There's, like, a significant portion of what leaders do in Congress that is that, right? Caucus meetings on Tuesday, yeah. Right? What it didn't used to be a normal thing. Why do we do it? Everybody get together. Let's talk about everything. Let's talk about how we're going to do some
things. It also gives, like, these
activities were... They're real parts of leadership, yeah. But, and they're trying to create a sort of social teamwork that is otherwise not there.
It also creates a very sort of low-level, low-boil loyalty hierarchy constantly, yeah. Right? If you constantly ask yeah. people to do these sort of relatively simple things, you figure out very quickly who's with you blindly, who's mostly with you but will tell you yeah. to pound sand, and then who is like just...
Right.
Not on your team.
So it's yeah. a whip operation in disguise.
And it also allows members to signal the exact same thing, right? If you send out the talking points every week to the members, and then one person is loyally, you know, going out to the mics and saying whatever dumb thing you wanted them to say this week, and demanding a one-minute speech to say whatever dumb thing you wanted them to say, like... You can probably count on that person, right? Yep.
Chocolate rations have been increased.
And the opposite is true, too, right? Like, I'm pretty sure Massey's office is not just going to go roll with your talking points, whatever. And we don't need the talking points to figure that out, but for some people, you do, right? Right.
That was the thing. There's a bunch of staffers. I was talking to one in particular when I was on Capitol Hill, and I was like, so these caucus meetings, like, who shows up? It's like the people who want to show up. Yeah. I'm like, so the pain in the butts don't show up. He's like, not at all. He's like, you're not voting for the bill? It's like having a caucus meeting after CR fails. Like, you're still not finding the, like, 30 or 40 people who didn't vote against it because they just haven't shown up, right? Yeah. They're intentionally avoiding you and your little, like, teamwork plan.
I do feel like there's a difference between, like, House Democrats and House Republicans there because, like, the House Republicans will show up to their conference meeting and be like, listen, pal. Right. Yeah. F you. I want that mic, and I'm also going to go yeah. meet to like 25
it's like
different
a
reporters.
Right. Weekly festivus. Right.
Yeah.
Give me the mic. I got to get out in the hallway. Yeah.
I love every time they send out the release saying, like, this is a closed meeting to press, and, right. Right. And then Jake Sherman's live tweeting it.
Yeah.
So, just I realize I'm about to ask you an impossible question, but we're about to go into maybe a slightly different primary environment, given the incoming president and his willingness to threaten members on a more frequent basis, on a more volatile basis. I mean, we saw the return of the Trump news cycle with, you know, the CR at the end of December, which I think our last podcast was like smack dab in the middle of that.
Yeah, that was amazing.
So, you know, you had 38 Republicans vote against it. You had a bunch of primary threats. So we're about to, while I think this is really good for kind of like core understanding of politics, we're about to be in a different primary environment. And what thoughts do you have about that?
I don't know if it's that much different. Okay. We do have
I think the number of primary threats, the volatility of them.
Especially yeah. coming from the White House.
Coming right. from the White House. That is the aspect that's yeah. different. I think everything else that you have is going to continue yeah. to be solid. But part of this has changed.
So we do have a section in here about like the timing of primary threats and yeah. when they, and at least when the threat is most pressing on members' considerations. And the quote we have in there is from a former floor director. It talks about how, like, you know, things we all know. The first year of Congress is when legislating can get done,
yeah.
and then after that, everything goes to hell because of electoral concerns. And so I think, you know, right now we've already seen primary threats looming, coming from the president, coming from
yeah.
like talking points people, like turning points or whatever they're called. And so, like,
turning
obviously,
points has talking points.
Yeah. you know, the I think the timeline's moved up. I don't know how much more impact that'll have than
yeah.
previous years.
Fair.
Like, people have short attention spans. So if it's an early and sustained call to primary certain people, then I think, yeah, that's going to have an effect on member behavior. But if it's a one-off truth or, you know, something like that, and that doesn't have follow-through on organizing for fundraising primary challengers or on-the-ground threats. I don't know if it has any different impact than previous.
I think that one of the more interesting things is the backward side of that is when the threat goes away, right? Because there's this idea some people have in their head that, oh, it's really hard to cut deals before the general election. Parties have incentives not to. But the one thing out of the way in the months leading up to the general is the primaries are gone.
Yeah.
Right? And so the pressure in the like late in December of the odd number of years, like this December, with all the primaries looming in the short term, that's a very different situation than a year from this summer when all the primaries are over, right? And that they're really not there, right? And it sort of comports with the idea that the vast majority of seats are more worried in some sense about the primary possibility than about the general election. The other thing with the primary calendar that people forget is that it's unbelievably spread out member by member and state by state. It goes on forever.
It runs from primaries at the end of August.
It runs from like February to August of the even number of year.
And they don't align with the presidential primaries for obvious reasons. Right. Like, it's like, name it, I don't want to be on the ticket with that
guy. It's not like you hit a date and all of a sudden the leadership's like, oh, the primaries are behind us. Yeah. And now we don't have to worry about that. It just keeps going and going and going.
And I would love a national primary.
Well, and we wonder why primary turnout is so low. It's because it's impossible to track. No one knows. It's all over the place.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that we're going to have like a different story from like Eric Cantor getting primaried by Dave Brat, doesn't see it coming, and, you know, conservative media and claims Joe about Crowley. Immigration end up being like kind of this late term spike in interest on the behalf of Dave Brat. And I realize that there's a larger narrative about that particular race, but I think that that kind of like surprise, like,
I feel like the AOC and Brat primaries are somewhat different than sort of like the Trump is angry that you're not tied in with the party. The Brat and AOC ones are some case about like leaders neglecting their district.
That's the other part.
Which is very different because in some ways that's a call to say you are not representing the district as a whole rather than you're not being conservative or liberal enough. And I think certainly in the Crowley AOC and, you know, and Brat Cantor one, maybe with Brat, it was a little more about ideology, but it really was run as like a shoe leather, where the hell you been, buddy?
Right. Well, I think that this conversation kind of speaks to what we hint at in the report, is that it's not the actual threats that manifest. It's the narratives around the losses. And so, for example, the Brat Cantor one, I have a little bit of on-the-ground experience with because I went to Randolph-Macon College, where Brat was from, was professor, and I was there during all of this.
And you were his campaign manager.
Not so much.
Did you know anyone who took his classes?
I know a lot of people who took his classes and worked on his campaign and in his congressional
office.
What
was he like as a prof?
No comment. I think so. Like the national narrative about at the time about that was it was immigration policy, and Cantor was out of touch with that. But Lauren Bell and Keith Gaddy write this great book called Slingshot, using contemporary evidence on the ground in the district, and it was like very little was about policy. It was about Cantor was never in the district.
Which is also like a bit weird because Cantor was in the district all the time. In fact, he lived in the district while working in D.C.
Right.
It's like even that narrative was sort of a little.
We also have staffers of his who are friends of GAI.
Right.
Heavily dispute that narrative.
Right. So, it's with primaries and like as we all try to figure out what they mean and their impacts, looking at the specific data we have available, but also kind of how members make meaning from it, I think is an equally important part.
Yeah, and that's like a great political insight. Jonathan Bernstein's always writing about that. That like you can figure out why events happened, but how the members and political actors in D.C. understand those events is more important. It's just more important.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter why Trump won the 2024 election. How the people in D.C. understand why he won is what is going to affect policy.
Well, this is Seth Maskett's book on like why people end up coalescing around Biden for 2020. It's like it's the lessons that they thought they learned the previous time. With that, do you want to move on to Congress?
Are the speaker fire terms?
Who are they?
The Speaker of the House ripped Mike Turner, the chair of the Intelligence Committee, out of his post and has replaced him with Rick Crawford, which is the most Arkansas name I could possibly come up with.
It's a kind of stunning turn of events.
I did not see it coming, but, strong supporter of aid to Ukraine. reportedly had some problems with the House Freedom Caucus.
I mean, that and possibly President Trump, who was not, I mean, Mike Turner was not like a Trump advocate, Trump ally. That's for sure. He took out a lot of stances. It's just, it is very unusual to, especially on the Republican side when you have term limits on these chairs anyway, to rip a chair out of a seat.
I don't know. I don't know a lot about the Turner and Johnson's relationship, but as kind of people are shifting around committee assignments, how much of it is Johnson now elected to his own full term as Speaker is kind of replacing people that were holdovers from McCarthy that he didn't have time or political capital to maneuver in the last Congress, and now he's trying to kind of get his allies into positions.
I would argue that's probably the case at some level somewhere. I can't tell if Turner's one of those spots or not, or if he's doing this for some other reason.
Yeah.
Just like in the same way that I'm confident putting Morgan Griffith on from Virginia on the Rules Committee is probably not in his interest either.
Yeah.
Morgan Griffith is a Freedom Caucus guy. He's going to be joining two other Freedom Caucus fellas on the Rules Committee, and that will become a Freedom Caucus block officially. Thomas Massey was a very, very conservative legislator, but he's got his quirks. He's like I'm conservative in my own independent kind of way. I'm gonna make like a bunch of weird designs. What's the he's got this chicken feeding thing that he's made. I don't know.
Oh, you're looking at me like I've got deep knowledge.
But this is the thing. But this is the thing. I mean, he's made this. He's created this like very novel sort of like. Like open field, or
he wants to be the Rand Paul of the House.
He's certainly the Rand Paul of the House, if not more Rand Paul than Rand Paul is in the House.
I want to Rand Paul off.
Who was the Democratic member from Ohio? The one who always tried to impeach George Bush. The super progressive. Why am I forgetting his name?
Oh, Democrat. Ran for president.
Yes.
The war.
Yes.
Outside of Cleveland.
Yes.
What the hell is his name?
I can't remember his name.
For God's sake.
It's going to drive me insane.
Anti-war Democrat from outside of Cleveland.
Oh, he's going to kill me.
This is ridiculous.
He's going to kill me. Oh, you got to look it up. But, like, Thomas Massey.
Sorry,
like,
my head is just stuck on Trafficant's hair. You said Trafficant and derailed my life.
It will get stuck there.
You're like Lunatic from Ohio, and I'm like, Trafficant. No!
Oh, it's going to kill me. I have his name on my
tongue. I do too.
It's absolutely going to destroy me. I can see his face. Anyway, he's like, they're so far out there, but they're like independent out there, right? They are driven by their own moral compass, and that is completely independent from any kind of party apparatus. And so having three conservatives
Dennis
on the rules. Dennis Kucinich.
How could I forget that? That
absolutely kill me. But having three actual, and having three conservatives on there with Massey was not like a Freedom Caucus guy. Like he's totally independent of them. He doesn't like playing with others in many respects. But Griffith probably does, right? And so Griffith, Norman, Roy would be an actual voting bloc that could create a lot of problems for me.
I don't think Griffith is as much of a firebrand as the other two, though.
Yeah, no, the same
no.
I feel like he's closer to go along to get along. I think it's an upgrade for Johnson, put it that way.
You do?
Yeah.
I think, I think Massey's fickle, but Massey can also just be like, fuck you. And be completely ungettable.
Well, Massey was...
ungettable.
Massey was critical in bringing, like, one of the omnibus bills.
Because
the two conservatives voted against it, and he was the one that helped it over the line the first time.
Put it this way, I don't picture Griffith putting his foot down on the speakership vote and being like, there's nothing you can do for me, right?
Yeah.
I will not accept Secretary of State.
No, but it's also like a Chip Roy kind of guy who's going to be on there and kind of against spending it all.
Yeah, yeah, no.
But also, like, Massey is now the guy with the Massey rule for, like, a 1% cut to spending if we don't, have something that's not a CR after May. Yeah. So, like, I remain to be seen that anybody else has that level of intransigence of a studied nature on rules vis-a-vis fiscal policy.
And it'd be interesting to see, like, if there are other chairs that Johnson removes. Like, that would be notable to do, but, like, so we'll have to wait to see if there's more context to this particular move. But this was certainly a shocking move.
Mike Turner was the first member of Congress I ever briefed when I was at CRS.
Mm. Oh, really? What'd you think of the guy?
He talked about karate.
I love it. I love it. any karate opinions you'd like to compare, Matt?
I just remember he was very much into karate, and we talked about it a lot. Like,
I don't know if you picked this up in your interviews, but like whenever I sit down with a member, the first thing we talk about is not at all the thing we were there to talk about. It's like completely different. It's like, yeah, like Colorado basketball. Like, of course, right? Why not? Like, yeah, let's go with that. And how are they doing? And
not so much in our interviews because they were very focused. But whenever I was briefing Modernization Committee members, it was always like anything but what we were there to be talking about. And then like the last 5 minutes, we're like, so by the way, we're doing this markup next week.
Like, do you have local sports? Yes, I have local sports. Awesome. A plus. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to kind of watch Johnson progress as a speaker and move forward. I mean, he's just kind of hit like kind of the bare but important minimum of like not shutting down the government and passing the NDA over his time so far, which, you know, important stuff, but also like bare minimum. And, you know, it's hard to... It'll be interesting to see his strategy kind of unfurl as we go forward. And I do think that he's, you know, like, people like to talk about the speakership being, like, the worst job in Washington, and I think there's a lot to that. But, you know, you also see certain things like this, like, PowerPoint that he just showed to, you know, his conference of, like, oh, here are the suggested due dates we have for when different things are going to happen. We're going to get together on appropriations bills. And, oh, also, we're going to send a reconciliation package to Trump around Easter weekend or Easter break. And you're like, oh, Muffin, like, this is... Like, who made your PowerPoint for you? Like, did you have, like, a high schooler on your staff?
I like the ambitious deadline.
I think it's because he, like, actually does believe in, like, the real version of regular order and wants to try to give space for that process to play out as opposed to the fake claims for regular order where people are just trying to get their preferred policy positions and claim lack of regular order whenever they don't get it. And so, like,
well,
he
does
seem like...
deadlines regular order,
but you have to have the deadlines so that you can backdate, you know, all the previous processes to get there, right? And, you know, he does seem like he wants to do that, but obviously coordinating Congress to ever be able to make it happen, it just never works.
Well, and in fairness, this is a impossibly heavy lift with tiny margins and bedeviled by everything from the fact that they don't know if they want one or two reconciliation bills, what's going to be in them. You've got Treasury's X date in you know, roughly 5 months out. That's going to bedevil the process. You got to fund the government after the Ides of March. Nice touch there, guys. like the pick of the date. You have so many like high profile, major compromises that have to be made with tiny margins and people who legitimately disagree, sometimes on policy and often on just politics and posture.
I think that's the all this talk about one bill, two bill for reconciliation is, like, it's not about the process. They're telegraphing the fight about the process because they don't agree on the policy.
I think there's a lot there. Right. I think there's a lot there.
I mean, the tax bill is so complicated itself. Never mind throwing everything else in with it. Like, how are you going to get the votes? I was struck by the gambit of, like, and it was just floated as a trial balloon of, like, oh, well, just tie the debt limit to disaster relief and let the Democrats pass it. I mean, whether things are realistic or not, I love gambits like that. I was like, someone was sitting around in an office going, oh, here we go. Just put the debt limit on, like, the, you know, make it like Section 7 of the disaster relief and see if the Democrats will vote for it.
This feels like you're playing.
With Ukraine aid.
This feels like you're playing, like, hearts or spades or something, and Mike Johnson has, like, the worst hand ever, and he's just trying to offload this crap card at any place. And it's just, like, every opportunity. This might be a great time for the debt limit. It's like, it's never a great time for the debt limit, dude. This never will it be a great. Hey, maybe this time. like, no, Mike, stop. Like, you've got to stop saying that word every time we come up with a potential deal.
Are we debuting a Mike Johnson impression?
I haven't ventured that far yet.
I think you're too tall to be Mike Johnson. Well,
I'm not ever trying to physically imitate any of the people that I impersonate, but
it is interesting to me that the slim margins in the House have led Senate Republicans to say, like, we'll take whatever you guys can send us.
Wow. Yeah. That's a big development.
Senators ever said that basically about things that never come out of the House.
Yeah, it does. Some of it does feel like a, because I agree with your sentiment there, like, whoa. But it does feel like, oh boy, let's just let them fuck it up and crash and burn, and then we'll come pick up the pieces kind of feel too, right? Because they do need to get into this reality that right now it's harder to get a reconciliation bill through the House and the Senate,
yeah.
Which is totally unusual,
right?
Yeah. At least in the long stretch of thinking about it. And so, like, why not let Johnson see what he can do? And if it works, great. If it doesn't, right, you can come pick up the pieces later. Did anyone read that article? I think it was Rachel Bade wrote that pretty long piece in the magazine yesterday about the Thune-Johnson relationship and how sort of icy it is out of the gate. That, you know, they're talking friendly in public, but they're having a tough time.
Well, I mean, he identified that January 6th was, in fact, Trump's fault.
Thune has not been, like, a hardcore Trump ally at every turn. I mean, he's certainly, like, given him, like, you know, a sort of nod, the tip of the hat, whatever you want to call it. But he was a very interesting pick in the Senate, very specifically because he was not, like, a true Trump guy.
Interesting, but also in line for the position.
Yeah.
You know.
Right,
surprising in that way.
Right, I mean, you know, the true Trump guy in that particular race was Rick Scott. And Rick Scott got 13 votes.
He always looks like a wild animal to me.
I took that vote as a sign that the Houseification of the Senate has not happened completely yet. Right, like, they're right. Still...
Didn't Jim Justice miss 2 votes yesterday?
Yeah.
And
still wants
for side note, did you see how tall Jim Justice is? Oh, my God. Yeah. I had no idea. What is he, like 6'6"?
Well, he missed 2 votes, and, like, there's reporting, and I didn't know about this, that many people were expecting this.
Yeah.
That, like, this is his, like, M.O. How the hell did you miss 2 random votes in the Senate early? Like, what's he doing?
Wasn't,
like,
he just sworn in?
He's late to the position.
Right.
Right.
Feeding he's finishing the dog, up. Walking the dog around Hart or something?
I don't know. I don't know. It will be interesting to watch. Evidently, this is not uncommon in West Virginia. But when he was governor, like, there were times where he was sort of just...
Doing what?
Just, you know, doing stuff. But...
don't give the guy a hideaway office.
That's one thing I sort of miss. It must have been 10 years ago now where they finally was like, fuck it, we just have 100 hideaways.
Yeah.
But there was that period where they only had like 70 hideaways. And so you're on like the hideaway bubble waiting for people to retire, right? You can get yourself into a nice cozy spot in the Capitol. They expanded to 100 maybe in 2014 or whatever. So
this is sponsoring primary challengers here.
I mean, it's like those low-end hideaways are like closets. Yeah. Though. Window. Yeah.
Now you're not waiting for a hideaway, you're waiting for, like, a good one.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, where's your hideaway? Well, it's down that hallway. It looks like a closet. How do you know it's a hideaway? It's got that little blue mat in front of it.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. All right. Well, we are approaching 50 minutes, and we all know nobody listens to a podcast beyond 50 minutes. So,
parting shots?
Anyone? Yeah. Do anybody have anything special?
I mean, it's going to be, like, the most interesting garbage fire for fiscal policy I've ever seen. It'll be fascinating, but I've kind of touched on a bunch of this stuff briefly, but, you know, we saw Russ Vaught in his confirmation hearing talking about impoundment. Like, there's a good chance that, like, the Supremes are going to be taking up impoundment, and we've seen their proclivities in terms of Trump administration already, so we'll, you know, layer that on top of both funding the government, a potential large tax package because the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act has major personal income tax provisions that are going to expire, everything else that these guys want to do, all of the different interesting policy fights, whether that be SALT or anything else, and like it's Schedule F. Like it's like a weird parfait cake of just like layers and layers at tariffs of like, you know, extremely consequential fiscal policy.
The
where
External Revenue Service.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant name. I think so. One thing that I think is fascinating, and maybe it's just a political scientist or a Congress nerd, is there's some reporting that over on the Hill, they don't want Trump to repeal a lot of executive orders and actions Biden's taken because they want to repeal them statutorily in Congress to gain the budgetary scoring savings.
Right.
Which
yeah.
is fascinating to
yeah,
think
yeah,
about,
yeah.
right?
Absolutely.
Totally fascinating to think about. And that also comes into play with the tariffs. I don't think it's going to happen. But when Trump uses an existing authority under statute to create a tariff, it doesn't score back into your reconciliation bill. But if you do the exact same tariff statutorily, it does score into your reconciliation bill. I don't think Trump has any interest in being handcuffed by statutory tariffs. But it is an interesting fight that is completely an artifact of the budget process, that how you go about achieving these savings. If Trump reverses executive order to cancel student debt, you don't get any savings. But if you throw in the reconciliation bill, you can find $250 billion worth of savings there. And that sort of, maybe not struggle, but coordination, it would be interesting to see how much they do end up getting savings off things that normally just would have been repealed by executive order.
Sure. Well, and I was looking at the House rules package to see if that we were going to see any of this current policy versus current law stuff. And that doesn't pop up there. I mean, the letter that a number of the House Freedom Caucus folks immediately sent to Johnson, like, mentioned dynamic scoring. To have a more, you know, which historically has been used to, you know, take macroeconomic changes into account when you are scoring revenue bills, specifically tax cuts, to make them look like they're not costing as much money. But it's entirely possible that, you know, this kind of your Ways and Means and Senate Finance leadership's preference for using current policy, that is to say, not counting the sunsetting of tax provisions as happening and just extending them, which makes it look like you're extending them for $0, as a, you know, potentially accounting gimmick, a gimmick not in the way that you're talking
yeah.
about, but you know, we will, that'll be another thing to look for.
Well,
how much do these guys really want to push it? Like, we'll see.
Before we started recording, there was reporting saying that some members of the Republican conference were pushing budget chairs to throw out the CBO scores and said, you know, if House
yeah.
and Senate budget chairs agree on a number, then they could just use that.
That's what, this is another spot where, not surprisingly, Punchbowl gets it wrong. I almost lit my hair on fire this morning.
You have hair, don't you?
CBO occupies the same role in some sense as the parliamentarian.
Yes.
You don't have
yeah.
to listen to them. Now,
right.
the senators do, and that's a good thing normally, right? We want these norms of stability,
yep.
and we want to trust these sort of independent experts to keep a precedent system going and have full knowledge. But, like, you don't have to, like, fire CBO in order to change the budget numbers.
Right.
Just do it, man. Just do it.
Right.
And
or just direct them to do something a certain way because they have to.
Exactly. And so, like, ultimately, this isn't up to CBO, even though in practice the CBO numbers become sort of what the senators are going to go for. But CBO has not been put in a place where they are deciding these things. I also think it's amazing because ultimately what the fight over is, like, how much are you willing to write the number in the reconciliation bill? You can write the deficit to be bigger. Right, just take the CBO score, dynamic or not, just write it twice as big if you want. But it really is, people don't want to write that big number.
Right.
So they'd rather sort of come up with a budget gimmick. And look, this is,
yeah.
this, they didn't invent this year, right? These budget gimmicks
sure.
are forever. But, like, it really is all about, like, how big a number are you willing to write into the budget resolution, right? Are you willing to say, you know, $10 trillion in
right.
deficit over the next 10 years rather than five or whatever?
Yeah.
Well, that's all I got. Should we wrap up?
Yep.
Yeah, I do want to recommend having more than one Labatt Blue in the fridge. I don't know what this garbage you guys are drinking.
Hey! I brought decent brown and corruption,
it's
which
very,
seemed
it's
on
very
brand.
Good.
Well. And then I brought some, like, decent, like, German
yeah,
beer.
Your definition
very
of decent
very
is
very,
you know,
very
like.
To bring it full circle, I brought a porter from a brewery in Jamestown.
So
yeah.
there we
yeah.
go.
Yeah. JD likes to chew his beers.
You're Mark Lauder.
Right, brought a porter.
JD, thanks so much for being here.
I know,
thanks
thank
for
you.
Having
really
me.
Appreciate it.
I don't know. The German purity rule is the only purity rule I can stand behind. This is what they have for their beer ingredients.
All right. We will catch you next time.
Yeah.
Thanks.